Hello, my name is Dr. Gary Collins. I'm a clinical psychologist and professor of counseling at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois. This is a tape about family relationships and discipline. It has been prepared by Dr. Grace Ketterman, who is author of a number of books and a practicing child psychiatrist on the staff of the Crittenden Center for Children and Adolescents in Kansas City, Missouri. This tape is not meant to replace a counselor, to answer all of your questions, or to solve your problems for you. It is intended, instead, as a supplement to counseling, an added plus that your counselor would like you to hear and discuss during later counseling sessions. It has been discovered in the past that listening to a tape can be helpful to people. Listen now as we talk to Dr. Ketterman about a number of issues relating to family discipline.
I work with a great many troubled children, and for every troubled child, there is an entire family that struggles with what has caused that trouble and, best of all, how to cure it. And today I'd like to work with you to try to prevent some of the problems that these families work with. I wonder if you know that one family out of two is doomed to face the struggle of divorce in today's world. Are you aware that in many classrooms, over 60% of the children come from either single-parent families or blended families that have gone through the loss of a parent and are trying, sometimes heroically, to put together a family that's workable and harmonious? Those are the troubles that I would like to help you prevent. And by listening and learning and practicing what we'll be talking about today, you can create a family that is balanced and harmonious.
Dr. Ketterman, how can individuals and family members create togetherness in their family relationships?
I know that families who have not learned how to communicate well are going to have trouble. I'm aware that families that do not know how to make a commitment to one another, parents who are not committed to their marriage and to each other, who are not really committed to sticking with their children through troubles, are going to have a much harder time raising successfully the child that they want to raise. Another issue that's extremely important is the attitude of the family. Can they be constructive and positive, or are they much more likely in their well-meant attempts to make things go right to be critical and perhaps even harsh in their attitudes, as well as too rigid and too confining in their policies and the way they run the family?
What brings about healthy growth in families?
The most wonderful thing in really successful families is an encouraging, appreciative attitude. When a child does not want to clean her room or rake the leaves, the parents need to require that the child follows through with requirements and responsibilities are lived up to. They need to do that in a way that is positive, not destructive.
How can families begin to build this?
As soon as children are able to do so, I recommend that families sit down around a table, that they talk about all of the needs and the problems and the responsibilities that need to be handled. If there is a problem, they need to listen to all sides of that. One of the common problems in most families is the sibling rivalry. Johnny thinks that he has to do so much more than Susie has to do, and Susie feels it's certainly unfair that Johnny only has to do the outside work and never has to do those awful dishes. So listening to both sides and helping interpret and explain to both sides of those problem issues what is really going on and helping each to understand the other is extremely important.
What about communication skills and family requirements?
Good communication skills really is the beginning. And then they need to sit down in that same meeting and think about what are the requirements. What should each child do that will contribute to the whole family? I urge strongly that parents not assign children the simple task of keeping their own rooms clean. I think that fosters a certain selfishness. Rather than that, I recommend the families have a general house cleaning time and that everyone work together to rake the leaves and straighten up the lawns and whatever needs doing can be done as a group. And then when the work is done, I recommend they sit down and have hot chocolate or cold lemonade, depending on the time of year, and really review what they've done and feel good about it. As those tasks are outlined and pulled together in a fairly assigned and perhaps a rotating fashion, I think it will eliminate most of those sibling rivalry struggles, will help each child to learn that he and she is important in the family, and it will give parents a sense of having taught the children not just a sense of responsibility, but of collaborating and working together in a fashion that makes them a unit, rather than little fragments that all go off in separate directions.
What about coping with peer pressure?
I think peer pressure often is a substitute for some troubles within the child-parent relationship. When children and parents have a lot of misunderstandings and there is generally a rebelliousness, I find that young people turn to their friends, and they use their friends almost as substitute parents. What their friends say is okay is what they use then as the authority, rather than what their parents say. Now, generally, that's because they like what the friends are saying a lot more than they like what the parents are saying. And to do away with that negative peer pressure, parents need to do several things. First, they need to be well acquainted with their children's friends. And I recommend that all families invite those friends to be in their home a great deal of the time. That enables them to befriend the children's friends, to help them sometimes when they may not have enough time with their own parents. It enables parents to know what is good and sometimes not so good about those relationships. And in fair and open discussions with their children, they can often help their children to recognize that this friend is really good for me and I'm good for him. And this friend is not so good for me, and I'm really not doing her any good either. Maybe we ought to cool it a little bit, as the kids say, in this relationship. So those are the things that I think parents can do to help themselves understand and guide their own children into healthy peer relationships.
Do parents learn from their children?
That is so true, that parents do learn from their children and that there is a lot of giving and taking. I would certainly urge that, particularly for adolescent age children, parents not give their children the answers, but lead them by thought-provoking questions into discovering for themselves the things that are good for them or that are not so good. Now, with children prior to the age of adolescence, parents do have to, at times, let their wisdom, which is certainly much, much greater than that of the young child, go into effect. And they make decisions for those younger children that those kids cannot make for themselves.
How can parents separate themselves from their children?
It is certainly difficult for parents to separate their children from themselves, or sometimes from each other or other relatives. One of the big handicaps that I find many parents have, and I have struggled with it in my own parenting, is that I often identify my child as being so much like me that I think she is me. I believe sometimes she thinks and acts and feels as I do, and that is not true. So parents, we all need to watch that carefully, that we separate ourselves enough from our children that they become separate individuals, and we allow that and encourage that identity formation, that independence that's eventually the goal for all of our children. When children have the misfortune to resemble Uncle John or Aunt Harriet, and maybe we've had some struggles with those relatives that makes them less than pleasant in our opinion, then we can unwittingly put on our children the negative qualities of those relatives. And again, we then have a problem in the child's self-image. The child's self-esteem may suffer because unconsciously we have laid on them attributes that really belong to someone else. And our negative attitude toward a child will often create a negative response in that child. So it becomes, in that way, a vicious cycle that leads to very bad behaviors and strained relationships. Learning to identify if you have a problem with the child. What is it that's making this relationship falter here? And looking at those habits and mannerisms and appearances, and sometimes even as small a thing as a gesture that can be irritating to a mother or father, can be understood when they remember that their mother or their aunt or uncle or someone acted exactly that way. Separating out that person from your child can enable you to offer your child that unconditional acceptance that is so essential to the child's well-being.
What are some of your thoughts on positive discipline?
I tell you, discipline is a major issue and one that I want all parents to learn about very carefully. Positive discipline I find extremely difficult for some reason for today's parents to understand. I find that they veer from one extreme to the other. On the one hand, they're permissive and allow the children so much freedom that they don't learn the things that they must learn to get along with each other in school and in the outside world. On the other hand, there are parents who clutch and become panicked or worried and become so rigid and unbending that children, I think, almost have to rebel in order to begin to separate and to establish some independence.
What are some principles on good discipline?
Let me just list some of the basic principles in good discipline that I have used so I know these work. The first and most important one is to be realistic in your expectations of children. That means that you don't expect too much and you don't expect too little as far as what they're able to do. My oldest daughter could make her bed very well by the age of 4. My son never did make his bed well, even by the time he left home at the age of 18 to go away to college. And that's just a difference in children. So knowing what to expect and how well they can do it is step number one. The next step is to be open with the children themselves. Talk with them about what would be useful to them in terms of helping to get along with each other, with their friends, with their teachers, and then help them establish some big, broad policies, not 100 little fancy rules that can't even be remembered, let alone followed, but basic, broad principles such as, you may not hurt each other. Now, that avoids listing you are not to kick or scratch or bite, and then find that you have forgotten to say don't pull your sister's hair. Those broad policies are much easier to remember and to enforce. Then have the children understand why these are important and get them to agree to it. Generally, I think children want to get along. They want to be good and they want to get along well with each other and their world. And so they're usually pretty willing to do that. The next step is to establish consequences. If you have learned self-control, so that you do not hurt each other, then you deserve some reward for that. And by reward, I do not mean extra allowance or lots of M&Ms. By rewards, I mean the parents' approval, their pride in that child's accomplishment of what for most children is very difficult, giving up what they want to do, what they feel like doing, in favor of consideration for another person. So the parents' praise and pride in that child's learning to control is usually enough of a reward, but that does need to be expressed on a regular and honest basis. On the other hand, most children don't always conform to those policies, and sooner or later they're going to break the very rules they helped to formulate and agreed to and may even have signed the contract about. And those children need to have some consequences. After the child is 4 or 5 years of age, and sometimes even earlier, I think the children should help formulate their own consequences of a negative sort. They need to say, well, when I hit, I need to stop playing and go and sit in time out for a few minutes. I may need to give up that toy for a few days in order to avoid being selfish with it. So getting the children's input is extremely important, but when they can't or don't come up with proper consequences, then parents need to do so. And I do not believe that spanking is always the best means of disciplining children when they have misbehaved or broken the policies. In fact, more and more, as children go through serious child abuse by parents who sometimes lose control in the process of spanking, I recommend that you not hit your children, not even with that proverbial wooden spoon, but that you restrain them when they need to be pulled away from a fight or from a risky situation, that you teach them to take time out themselves and go to their rooms, think about what they have done that's wrong. If they're old enough to do so, I recommend asking them to write it out, because that does make them think and helps them to learn where they went wrong and how they can prevent going wrong in the future. The biggest step of all in proper discipline and training of children is that of the parents' follow-through. It's easy to set the rules. It's not very difficult to set up the consequences. What is really difficult is following through when you're busy. A mother who is fixing dinner and has six things going at once, and the phone ringing, which it always does at my house, or the doorbell ringing, does not always remember to follow through with teaching her child to learn that self-control. She must keep her priorities straight. She must find the time to turn off the cooking dinner and let the doorbell ring while she attends first to those needs of her children that are so urgent in the formation of their very characters. While mothers often get too busy with multitudinous duties at home, fathers often get too busy with their work. And I find that many children tell me their fathers just aren't around very much. Or if they are at home, they're tired and taking a nap. Maybe they're watching television and catching up with the latest sports. But they are not available to those children. And I urge fathers everywhere to discipline their lives, to devote time, energy, and attention to those children.
What do we mean by a father's availability?
The availability of the father means that he is accessible to the child, that he doesn't say, as he watches the Monday night football game, "Go away, I'm busy," when his son comes and wants him to help with homework. He doesn't say, "I don't have time to go to your games." He makes the time and makes himself available to the activities, the interests, and the needs of his children. When they come and say, "Daddy, please play with me," certainly Daddy may need a few minutes to rest, and that's always okay to say, "Son, I need 5 minutes to just unwind. I've had a rough day." But when that 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever time is set is up, then Dad needs to make himself get up, whether he feels like it or not, from that easy chair and go and follow through with his commitment to his child. I can almost guarantee that if more fathers and mothers will follow through with their commitments to their children, they will find their children following through in their responsibilities as well.
How does all of this apply to feelings?
In the whole area of feelings, I find that very many times parents are not comfortable. In fact, they're much more likely to say to their children, "Boys don't cry," or "Girls don't hit," or "Girls don't get angry," or whatever their particular belief system does or does not allow. One time I sat with a father and his teenage daughter, both of them beautiful people, but not very beautiful to each other. The father was saying to her, "Sally, you never talk to me. You never tell me how you feel or what's going on in your life. I see you talking to your mother sometimes, but I feel really badly that you don't come to me and talk to me about it." And she said in reply, "Dad, this is the first time I've heard you ever say that you wanted me to talk to you about how I feel. You never talk to me about what you do or how you feel or what's going on in your day, and I just don't think about it. I don't think you really want to hear from me." Now, both of them had developed some defenses, and both of those defenses centered around their uncomfortableness with expressing feelings. And it was wonderful to teach them how to begin to tell each other, "Hey, I've had a rough day. I had lots of things that happened that were very hard to handle. And so I'm tired and I need a little rest. And then when I've rested, Sally, I want you to come and tell me about your hard day, because I bet you've had a rough day, too. I know you had an exam in history, and how did it go? And sometimes parents can even forget their fatigue in getting into that kind of sharing, not just about activities of the day, though that often is the entree, but about the feelings that clustered about those events of the day. And then the feelings, once they're talked out, can clear the air within each person. What happens when they do not talk out those feelings is that each of the two or three or more act out their feelings. Children commonly act out their feelings about something that went wrong at school or while they were out playing on each other. They kick and hit their brother or sister or maybe the pet. Parents, on the other hand, tend to wall themselves off from those around them when they've had a difficult day. Those men particularly, who are taught so carefully in our world to be strong and be tough, will tend to go off alone and avoid contact with anyone who might pick up the fact that they're worried or afraid or angry or anything that has any emotional component.
What about the importance of family traditions?
Traditions within families today are sometimes events of the past. In the families who become removed from their extended families, they no longer live close to grandparents, uncles, or aunts, or cousins. They tend to go off on a tangent and do their own thing and maybe develop their own habits of living. I think it's extremely important for children to learn about their ancestors. I will never forget about the grandmother who lived with us when I was growing up until I was almost 17 years of age. She told me stories about the days of the pioneer era when there were no telephones. She described how it was to get on the train in Pennsylvania and travel all alone out to Kansas. She revealed to me that she had been told there were no trees and very little water, and that it was just a desert out in Kansas. And when she alighted from the train at the little town where she met her fiancé, she was amazed to find nice houses and tall trees, and was delighted to find that it was not a country of savageness and desolation. Those stories have made me aware of the history of my country. But much more importantly, those stories made me aware of who I am, and they gave me some of the courage that my grandmother had. Her willingness to leave a group of people from whom it was extremely rare for a young woman to depart gave me the courage to get into my career in medicine. Not very many women went to medical school when I was a young person, and it's those issues that I love to have families look at and communicate about in talking about traditional lifestyles, traditional values, and then traditional customs. It's extremely important that birthdays, special holidays throughout the year, have something that will renew the memories of the past. Christmas, for example, or Thanksgiving, or the 4th of July, all have very special customs that each nationality or ethnic background observe. If we lose the practice of those customs, our children will become less attached, less secure, less confident in the way they practice those special events. But if we can teach those traditions like New Year's Eve parties or church services, Christmas Eve services or dinners, whatever the celebration might be, there are certain things we do. Then not only do we enjoy this year and this event, but we enjoy all of the memories of all the past years and even the past generations. As we understand so clearly in the celebration of Thanksgiving, we hardly go through a Thanksgiving without remembering those first Pilgrim Fathers and the Thanksgiving that they expressed with the friendly Indians who had helped them adapt to this cold and forbidding country. Those traditions are extremely vital as a part of every child's development of identity, self-esteem, and the settling effect of planning a future life for future generations to come.
What is the importance of spiritual aspects in family life?
In today's world, the spiritual aspect of family life has often been neglected. And yet many studies have indicated that practicing their own particular religious faith is one of the secrets of strong families. And I urge all families not just to go to the church or synagogue of their choice, but to practice whatever it is that they believe every day within their family. One of the treasured memories of my childhood is that of my father and all of the family, my grandmother and eventually 7 children and my mother, all gathered every morning in the living room of our home. There my father would read a little bit of scripture and he would offer a prayer for our day. It was such a secure feeling that came to me from that ceremony. Somehow I knew that whatever I did and whatever happened that day had the surrounding presence of a power far beyond my own that I related back to my father's prayers. In fact, I suspect that some of my concept of God today really relates to my concept of my father, who was a wonderful role model of a strong, protective, and loving, and very positive father. For me, the belief in a heavenly father is identified by my dad. And I like that. I think that's quite all right, though God is certainly much more than that. Yet as a child, we need to start somewhere. And all of us, even as adults in the spiritual area, are something of children because there is more to learn, more to know, and more to practice than we will ever be able to master. I think it's difficult for children to go off to church and Sunday school if that is the only way a family practices their religion, by sending those children off to Sunday school alone instead of going with them. I think it's very essential that parents and children alike consider church important enough that in their own way, within their own framework, they observe at least that ceremonious type of worship on some regular basis. Then I think parents need to talk about their faith, not just to do those ceremonial, ritualistic kinds of things, but to talk about what it is that God did for me today. I know many times I have nearly had an accident or I have had something that could have been disastrous in my life, and I choose to believe that God, through His guardian angels, has looked after me and taken care of me. And I many times have called my children, even though they're now adults, and have shared with them the excitement and the joy of knowing that God has taken care of me, and I think has taken care of them as well. That's what I consider really important in practicing religious values within the family.
All parents have made mistakes in child rearing. How do we handle our mistakes?
I think all families fit that category. I can look back over my life as a mother and now as a grandmother and realize that with the best of efforts, the best of intentions, I made some pretty sorry mistakes. And I want to offer to all parents the hope to correct those mistakes. With my son, for example, I became a very nagging mother. He was a daydreamer, wonderfully creative child, but he didn't always remember to feed the dog or take care of the duties he should do. And so I would remind him and then nag and fuss and really established a very negative, critical attitude toward him. When he was in junior high school, I began to realize that it was not so much his forgetting to feed the dog, but it was my yelling and fussing at him about that had created the problems. And so I sat down with him and told him how wrong I had been, how my reminding him and punishing and scolding and lecturing him had been out of my attempt to help him develop more responsible habits, but that in focusing on those negative problem areas of life, I had totally forgotten to remind him of how generous he was, how kind and loving he was. I never heard him be grouchy or irritable or be critical of his friends or even his sisters. And how wonderfully responsible he was when it came to scouting and activities in which he felt comfortable. That conversation was a major turning point in our lives, and that's the kind of thing I recommend parents do who may be making mistakes and are now aware of having been too harsh, too critical, too negative, too confining. When you have realized that, sit down together and talk about it. Apologize for those mistakes, and then come up together with a plan for change. I and my son decided that I would not call him 65 times every morning. I would call him twice, once to be sure he was awake, and then once to be sure he had not fallen back asleep. Then, if he was not up and dressed and ready for school when the bus came by, he would simply have to walk. I think he walked one time before he decided that it was easier to get up and get himself together. I no longer had to nag. He didn't go off to school feeling angry, and I didn't go off to work feeling guilty because of having been too harsh with him. So having a plan for a new attack at those problems that will still be there and need addressing, and yet not continuing with the old negative habits, is the hope for changing and making out of those difficulties an even better and stronger relationship, because I believe I gave my son that day the example of making a change. When you have been doing something wrong, don't keep doing it harder and longer, but drop those bad habits and develop some good ones instead.
Now that we have completed side one of the tape, please turn over the tape and begin with side two. Several years ago, a friend of mine described how that on New Year's Day, he sat down and jotted down on paper his goals for his family. He'd been reading in the newspaper what politicians and government officials and church leaders had as their goals for the coming year and the coming decade, and he began to wonder what goals he had for his own family. Have you ever thought about that? What kinds of goals do you have for your own family? Do you have family goals? On the guide sheet, there is a small chart that has been prepared, listing the mother, the father, and the different children in the family. If your family is different, you may want to have different family members' names on the chart. But when you have the opportunity to do so, in a few minutes, please write down your goals for the different members of the family. Assume, for example, that you are the father. What is your goal for the mother of the family, or for yourself, or for each of your children? Are there obstacles in reaching these family goals? What are some of these obstacles? Then, in the third column, jot down what you can do to remove some of those obstacles and to help each of your family members reach the goals that you have set up for them. Remember that your goals may not be the same as the goals of each of these family members, so it can be helpful for you to complete the chart and then discuss it with the different family members. What are their goals for the family? When the family is working together on similar goals, then you are going to have greater cooperation and often better family relationships. Please stop the tape at this point and complete the chart on your guide sheet. Have you ever wondered how people learn? There are probably three important ways. Sometimes we learn by hearing instruction. Somebody tells us something, we listen and we learn. Sometimes we learn by following an example of somebody else. Or thirdly, we learn by getting experience. Instruction, example, and experience. These are the ways we learn things in life. Many years ago, I decided that I was going to learn to play the piano. I didn't get very far because I was an adult, but my teacher followed these principles. First, she gave me instruction on piano playing. Secondly, she gave me an example for me to follow. And thirdly, she gave me some experience at the piano keyboard myself. Raising children and disciplining children is very much like this. The Bible, in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, tells fathers, and this could also apply to mothers, to bring up their children in the training and instruction of the Lord. It says, incidentally, that they should not exasperate their children in this process. Here you have the emphasis on specific verbal training and instruction. That is one way to train children. What about an example? Well, all through Ephesians chapter 5, we see behavior that parents should experience in their own lives. And these examples are behaviors that their children can observe and follow. Paul himself, when he was writing to the Corinthians, in chapter 11, verse 1, says, "Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ." Paul was being an example for other people to follow. If we are parents, our kids follow our examples, whether we like it or not. And very often, our actions speak much louder than our words. But not only is instruction important, not only is our example important, but there is also the importance of experience, giving our kids experience as they move out from our homes. There is an interesting example in Luke chapter 9 of how Jesus trained the 12 disciples. Certainly he was not dealing here with family relationships and child discipline, but we see that he was applying some of these principles. He called the 12 together, he gave them power, and then he gave them instruction and sent them out to preach and to heal the sick. He told them what they should do when he went out. He gave them instruction. He gave them the experience as he sent them out, and they went from village to village, preaching the gospel and healing people. Then when they came back to Jesus, they talked about what they had learned. They discussed their experiences. And then some people came to Jesus late in the afternoon. They too needed to hear the good news of the gospel. They too needed healing. And Jesus gave the disciples an example of what he did as he reached the crowds around who had needs. So instruction, example, and experience was even part of the way in which Jesus trained people. Every family is different. Each family has its unique set of challenges and unique set of discipline problems to be worked out. Most of us know about Lee Iacocca. Not only is he a famous, well-known businessman, but he's written a couple of books that have sold millions of copies. In one of these books, he talks about his role as a father. He says, "Of all the tough jobs that I've had in my life, none has been tougher or more important to me than my job as a dad. When I die," he said, "if I can say that I've done well with my family, then I've lived a full life and a good life." "You're only as good as the sharing you've done with those around you," he wrote, "especially the sharing you've done with your family." When I get to heaven, I suspect God is going to ask me to give an account of my work as an employee, maybe as an employer, as a citizen, as a church member, as a counselor, maybe as a speaker on this tape, as an author. But when we get to heaven, God will ask us to give an account of the work that we've done in this world. But he's also going to ask how we did as marriage partners and how we did as parents. May God give us the wisdom to do a good job so that when we get to heaven and we're talking about raising our kids, he will be able to say to us, "Well done, thou good and faithful parent." When you are finished with this tape, please return it to your counselor. If you have another counseling session, be sure to take this guide sheet and your written notes with you. Your counselor will want to talk to you about some of the ways in which you have responded to the interview and some of the ways in which you have completed the chart and filled out the questionnaire that's listed on side 2 of the guide sheet. As you work together, may God guide as you talk about some of the creative and helpful ways in which you can build family relationships and deal with the discipline issues that are raised in your own family.